Alex, hey, it's James West. How are you?
Hi, James. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Certainly changed times and uncertain and interesting times, but glad we could get together today and talk about Fluence Analytics.
Yeah, crazy times for sure, and appreciate that you're able to make the time.
Of course. Well, this is our 30th installment of the Invest with James West series. This is another episode where we're sitting down with the CEO of a private company backed by venture capital that's leaning in with technology offerings. And this one's unique as this company is in the business of helping the chemicals industry enable optimization through control. For those of you that don't know, Fluence Analytics is a manufacturer of measurement systems that produce unique data streams, enabling real-time optimization of manufacturing and R&D processes. Alex Reed is currently or is the co-founder and CEO of Fluence Analytics, which was started in 2013 as a spinoff from Tulane University. Prior to Fluence, Alex worked as the Associate Director of Operations and Strategy at the Tulane PolyRMC and R&D Center, which is active in fundamental and applied polymer research. Alex was recognized by Forbes in 2016 as a 30 Under 30 recipient for his work with Fluence and received his BA in Economics and Business from Tulane University. So again, Alex, welcome to the podcast series.
Yes, thank you.
So most of our Alex, most of our guests that we have work strictly within the confines of kind of oil and gas. However, you're more in the manufacturing industrial sector, given the multiple industries that Fluence works with. So at a high level, could you describe what Fluence does and how it benefits customers and how you get paid for that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So Fluence provides a technology solution that actually can make measurements in processes in real time. And basically, we're delivering data sets that our customers have never had before through hardware and software. And with that, our customers are able to assess what they're making in real time and optimize their production. And we get paid on that through different ways, either through just the sale of the technology with some services, or doing a subscription to the hardware and the software, or even leasing with some service offerings. So we have several different business models we use with different clients.
Understood. So I think I'm pretty sure you're the first Forbes 30 Under 30 guest I've had on the podcast. So I find it interesting that Fluence Analytics was spun off from Tulane. So before we get into some of the technology here, can you speak about the origin of Fluence Analytics and what prompted the spin-out from Tulane?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, we're down here in New Orleans, Gulf Coast, where there's obviously a lot of petrochemical manufacturing. And over the years at Tulane, there was that research center that you mentioned in the introduction that was doing quite a bit of work with a number of different chemical companies, and obviously also had grant funding and other sources of investment into R&D. And from that, our technologies were the initial technologies were patented and prototyped and developed working with companies directly. And interestingly enough, the person that runs that center is my father. So I actually
Sure.
grew up working in the lab at a young age, and then became very interested more on the technology side. And then with our CTO, Mike Drensky, and our chairman, Bill Bottoms, who's an experienced venture capitalist and executive in Silicon Valley, who's also on the board of Tulane, the four of us started the business and were able to spin it out. And so I took on the role of the entrepreneur with Mike as the CTO, and we licensed the technologies and started doing deals directly with some of the customers that were funding the research at the center, because we would do the work. And they said, "That's really cool. You can do this. Well, how do we actually get this into our plant?" And at that time, we were a research center. We said, "Well, that we don't have that. We're just doing research." So you
Right,
get
sure.
that question enough, you decide, "Hey, why don't we actually do something with this and actually see if one of these companies wants to partner with us?" And that's what we did.
Okay. So if I think about the traditional process for measurement and control systems, it seems like they are, highly inefficient, hours of turnaround time. Why is the industry now becoming open to using new tech to increase productivity and efficiency? And what was the opportunity set that you saw that wasn't apparent to others?
Yeah, great question. So I think in general, and I'm sure you've seen this with this podcast, but in general, many industries, especially some of the more, labor intensive or asset intensive, have started to make a push for productivity and efficiency. So what we're seeing is more of a general industry trend where people are saying, okay, yeah, we know the way we do it works and we can make money doing it, but there has to be a better way. And the way technology is moving and the pace it's moving, what's out there that can help us get better, cheaper, faster? And so really, I think timing is really good because a lot of people are looking into that, you know, what type of data, what type of sensors can we add to make it more quantitative rather than qualitative? And so the opportunity we saw was specific in our industry. It's actually quite complicated to do some of the things that we do online. So a lot of people were still relying on offline measurements, you know, taking operators, going to the lab, et cetera. And so with that, there was a gap and a need to say, well, if we could deliver this data to you in real time, what would that do for you? And so those conversations were always well received, and that's what started to drive some adoption, and we saw the interest.
Interesting. Okay, so your AECOM product, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. If not, please do correct me. But it serves the polymer industry, which we've broken down into, you know, hundreds of markets and specific applications, whether it be paints and rubbers, adhesives, plastics, enhanced oil recovery, chemicals, water treatment, construction, materials. For which market do you have the best value proposition, and which opportunity is most exciting to you at this point?
There's quite a few. So as you noted, you know, there's a whole subset of industries. So targeting a few initially was our priority, because if we decided, hey, we're going to go after all of them at once, we might have had some trouble to actually service those markets. So we focused in with a lot of the early customers, which initially were specialty, so higher value batch type production where saving a batch or cutting your cycle time can increase directly the value of your production. And then we start to look more at some commodity materials, which are more continuous manufacturing processes.
Right.
And we also saw opportunities there where, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% improvements in quality or grade transition, things like that, added up to pretty significant savings over the course of a year. So initially it was more specialty on the value prop side, but then we started to see commodities. So we're not currently limited by the value proposition the markets we're in. We're more limited by the markets we're in, just based on the fact that there's so many.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. So now that we have a better understanding of Fluence and your end markets, can you talk about the Series A financing? How do those conversations come together, and what prompted you to choose Energy Innovation Capital and Mitsubishi Chemicals VC arm to invest? And are there some learning lessons you've gained that they're taking on outside capital?
Yeah. So our first investor was our first institutional investor was Energy Innovation Capital. So.
Right.
When we met that group, we were very impressed. You know, a lot of them had that corporate venture experience. They had deep networks in oil and gas, and obviously also by proxy petrochemical because of the downstream. And so it was almost a no-brainer when we partnered up with them. Said, look, these guys know our type of industries. They're actually one of the few groups that's investing in energy and industrial innovation. Because I'm sure, as you know, a lot of venture investment is going in other industries.
Right.
And so that was a unique opportunity and partnership to work with those guys. And then as we built some traction and started working with a number of chemical companies, we started to talk to some CVC arms. One of them was Mitsubishi Chemical in Japan. So they're obviously a top 10 petrochemical manufacturer. And they saw tremendous value across, now we're talking and engaged with, 6 or 7 business units.
Right.
So they said, well, you know, this type of technology could actually improve our operations across a whole swath of areas. And so they were very keen on the partnership, and so were we. And they're not the only customer that's investor. We have another one as well. And so what we've started to see is that having someone like Mitsubishi and other customers to partner on the investment side is we learn a lot more about applications. There's a lot more opportunity for partnership to drive the technology to continue to add more value. And so that's where those relationships are pretty tremendous for a startup in this type of space, especially. And the biggest lesson, you know, that we've learned is the network effects you get from bringing in capital like that. Because, you know, initially, if it's just a few people and you have a limited network, all of a sudden you activate groups that are global. Then all of a sudden you're talking to experts anywhere in the world. In your space through those connections. So it really does take you to another level.
Understood. So I think you're up to, you know, more than a dozen customers today, several of which are, you know, in the top 20 chemical companies in the world. You've got a lot of activity going on in Europe and Asia. You know, was that a strategic initiative, and how does that work for a U.S.-based startup? Do you need to, or have you expanded your sales or operational footprint to achieve this?
Great question. So a lot of that initially was pull. So, you know, people would find us, there were problems in their production, and they would look and say, hey, you know, here's some technology that could be useful. And so initially we're saying, well, that's great. You know, let's talk to you. And some of these regions were pretty heavily, innovation rich areas, you know, Japan, you know, Europe, especially, they invest quite a bit in R&D. So it was interesting to get that interest. And then as we started to go into those markets and see those opportunities, it became far more strategic and say, all right, well, look, you know, these are big markets and we have key partners here now. So let's start to focus on these. And so obviously as a small U.S. company, it's very difficult to scale and work across all these time zones. So the key is to have in-market partners. So we have expanded through partnerships and relationships in the geographies that we're in. We find that is an easier initial way to do it rather than setting up offices and locations in all those places. So as soon as you have that footprint and justification, then those could be the next phase of the expansion.
Right. Okay, so let's jump into the technology a little bit further. So your products, you've got ACOMP, you've got Origin. Can you describe at a high level how we should think about both of these products and particularly the problems that they solve?
Yeah, ACOMP is extremely focused in the petrochemical polymer side. So
okay.
That's the one we've mainly been talking about. So real-time monitoring and optimization in manufacturing and R&D. Origin is a different product line, and the key connection between them is some of the core technologies used in them are things that we have IP on going back to the days at Tulane. So we had, just because the technology was there, we were able to develop this Origin product, and with that we've been working with some biopharma companies, so completely different space, in looking at mainly protein and peptide, so a lot of the more modern biopharmaceutical drug treatments. So the tool Origin can be used more for formulation, so people knowing when a formulation is stable or ready to be released for production. So that's the type of application for Origin.
Okay, makes sense. So what's the typical engagement process that you undergo when it comes to onboarding new clients? What's the, you know, the beginning to end product lifecycle process usually like?
So typically, you know, once we've gotten to the point where we know we've identified, you know, the client has a specific need and we know that our technology is addressing it based on those initial conversations, we then move to understand more about how the technology will integrate and then how we can then execute a project with them to get our systems installed. And so in that, we'll be able to work with local teams at the different facilities for the customer, get the product in, and then from there, we go to, you know, commissioning, startup, and then service support, starting to offer some data exploration, data visualization tools around our specific data sets. So that's typically how it evolves, is initial understanding, you know, deployment, and then ongoing relationship around service of the actual hardware, but also the value that is derived from the data.
Right. Okay. In ACOMP, this product applies automated real-time measurements on Polymer products, as I understand it, and you use proprietary software to produce data used by the customer. You know, what parts of the process is owned by Fluence, and can you walk through some of your R&D priorities and the patents that underlie or underlying that business?
Sure. So, yes, the parts that we specifically work on and have IP around are in the actual measurement hardware, in a lot of the algorithms that we use to analyze the data that comes from that hardware, and then also some, I guess we would call them right now is more prototype algorithms, so we're still in development talking to the R&D priorities, on actually controlling processes. So we've done those at smaller scales, and we are, you know, working or looking to work with companies to scale up the control side. So everything, yeah, from the hardware to the data analysis to potentially software-based control are areas that we own and work on. And we actually have patents that cover each of those. So different configurations of the hardware, types of sensors used in the hardware, and then, like I mentioned before, the actual algorithms used for the data, sure, and then for control. So, yep.
Okay. And then, you know, I guess the incumbent solutions, as I understand it, would be manual sampling or differential models and chemical analyzers. So how does ACOMP stack up against those historical solutions?
Great question. Yeah. And so what we've seen in the space is the biggest thing is, you know, people continue to operate the way they do. So sampling manually and being satisfied that you run this recipe the way you've been running it for 30 years and it works and it's fine. So that's the biggest inertia, right, is getting somebody to change the way they've been doing something. Some companies have been more proactive and innovative. They've looked at different types of mathematical modeling, or some single parameter type analyzers. So really where we differentiate is that we are making multiple parameter measurements in real time that can also be used for modeling. So not only are we making physics-based measurements of the process, but that data then can drive some of those existing models they've developed for control. So that's our key differentiator, is that we have obviously the IP, but also the fact that we're doing multiple measurements that no one's able to make in these processes.
Okay. And then what's the future state of ACOMP product that you envision? Is it some kind of holistic suite that would handle the polymer production analysis, or do you plan to provide certain components of the process and piecemeal? How are you guys thinking about the, as this product is rolled out further, you know, what the what it would look like, you know, in kind of real time?
Yeah. So the big vision is to continue to expand it through many other markets in polymers, but also potentially to other types of applications completely. And so following the thread of value in other places and saying, okay, you know, if we can apply some of these same measurements to some other type of manufacturing process, you know, what value do you derive from that data? So that's a big initial push for us on the development side, is, you know, continuing to push new applications. But we're also getting at in the question is, you know, what are we actually offering? And it is a holistic suite. It is something that is a hardware software solution. We combine them together in the package. But as I mentioned before, we want to continue to follow the data. And so with all of this time series data we're providing, we now can add additional context to manufacturing and quality programs that customers have. And so with that, we see other opportunities for software products. So down the line, that's really the big push, is can we drive some additional software around the hardware?
Makes a ton of sense. So, you know, we're pretty familiar with the pitfalls and potential of big data, as some applications of it have been used in the old patch already. What do you see as the biggest challenges your organization faces when it comes to handling big data? And have you had to change or expand the company or workforce to deal with these challenges?
Yes. Yes, we have. You know, you learn. Yeah, you learn as you go, right?
Right.
So, you know, initially, all we knew about was the data we were generating. So we said, okay, you know, this, we have our time series database with these data points, and, you know, how do we make sure all of our typical blocking and tackling of corralling your data to analyze it. And you see this in many applications. You know, can you get it all into the same type of format? Are you able to mine it properly? And so those were some of the initial challenges everyone has. But then for us is really tying it to other data sets and adding, like I said before, that context based on time series, you know, because it's all about what we see is the evolution of processes in time. That's what's most valuable, is sure. How are things changing in real time? And so that does require some different skill sets. And so we actually had people that were more subject matter experts in our technology that got interested in data science, that have been really training more in that space. So we started to shift them more in that direction. Because this is such a new field, finding qualified people in big data, like you were saying, is not easy. So sometimes right. You have to train them yourself. There are people that you can contract, and a lot of times what you do is you find people from other industries and repurpose them and say, okay, you know, you applied some of these principles and maybe even financials, you know, financial modeling. Can you do this type of thing? Because that's time series data. Can you do this type of thing in a production environment? So you just have to be creative in how you view people's skill sets and how they fit in.
Understood. Okay. And maybe just to get into the financials, I think I noted that AECOM can be treated as an operating expense or CapEx. How is the product tailored based on whether a customer wants to expense it or capitalize it, if any changes are required at all? And is there any noticeable patterns of behavior among your client base in terms of which one they choose?
Yeah. And this is interesting, because everyone is at least shifting towards a model where they offer it or almost exclusively go to some kind of subscription or OPEX, right?
Sure.
And what's also interesting is in oil and gas, you've seen service companies and stuff doing it for a long time. And so, you know, leasing and contracts and kind of more pay-as-you-go models. Mm-hmm. In manufacturing, that exists in a few places, but not typically. You know, it's usually been heavy CapEx investment type space. And so, you know, some customers are used to using that. You know, they have good balance sheets and they prefer to do that. But some smaller companies or companies that want to be able to try things at a lower price point and maybe do it in a few places where you don't have to go through more extensive approval processes, are attracted to things like the leasing and the subscription model. So
right.
We haven't seen this. So I'd say the pattern is more in that, you know, maybe larger, more established companies prefer to use their CapEx model, whereas smaller, more nimble clients like to have that approach of, you know, paying as you go.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I know part of last year's fundraise was for you guys to invest in your paid proof of performance trials, sales activities, software and hardware. How do you plan to invest in those areas to achieve more success? And what do you envision the next round of growth capital to be invested in?
Yeah, we plan to keep investing in those areas. What we've seen, and I'm sure you've seen this too, in oil and gas, is that some of these larger companies are not quick to adopt new technology.
Right.
You know, they like to see it in action. You know, they always ask you, well, who else is doing it? So there is an interesting, you know, tipping point phenomenon you see in adopting technology that that proof of concept, proof of performance model can be used for. So we've been, just like a lot of companies, doing those. You work with a company, they pay. We actually will send a machine and an engineer for 3-4 weeks. We go get data on a process or on a pilot line, and then that's used to then justify and, you know, future engagement for, like we talked before, either a purchase or a subscription. And so that model initially can be very valuable. And then as you build up proof points and then you have some reference customers, the conversations shift. You don't need to keep proving it. It's okay, we know it works and we know it works well in this application. You know, let's go. So that is where we're focusing. And then that's actually part of the sales activity. And then on the software hardware side, we talked earlier about some of the key priorities of, you know, developing out the data applications and expanding the hardware for new markets.
Sure.
And then as we go forward, you know, we plan to keep investing in a lot of those areas, and then I'd say doubling down more on that data thread. So as we have more of an installed base that was generated from this proof of performance strategy, we can then invest a lot more into the data that comes off those machines. So it's all about building the installed base initially.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So maybe a couple parting thoughts for me. So how will investors, industry observers know that Fluence Analytics is executing on your milestones? And what are the key milestones for 2020 and 2021 to let us know that the plan is on track and being executed?
So the key areas for us, as we were just talking about, is, you know, getting as many of these proof of concept, proof performances done. So that, as I described, you know, it is not a simple process because we have to send an engineer and a machine because it's such a valuable part of our sales tool. So, you know, our goal was to do 8 to 10 of those this year. Hopefully, we can maintain that track. We already had done 3 as of this first quarter. And we want to keep moving forward. And so that's a key milestone. And then from there, it's conversion. You know, once we have data and we are in front of new customers and they see what it can do, do they commit? Do they move forward? Do they buy? And so far, we've seen that. We've seen that quite a bit, actually. So of the ones we did last year, we saw 75% conversion. So I'd say... Yeah. And so I'd say for us, that's how we'll know that we're on track, is are we getting these done and are we moving our pipeline along to that adoption?
That's very impressive. So I guess the last one for me, what's something that investors and market observers don't realize about Fluence Analytics?
So, I mean, a lot of our conversations, because we have a hardware component, a lot of our conversations are focused on, you know, the measurements and things we can make. But what a lot of people aren't realizing is the fact that these are data sets that no one is able to get today in this space. And so, you know, being able to drive these types of processes from data like that is extremely unique. And so being able to communicate that to the markets, and maybe this will help, is that, you know, there's a huge opportunity beyond just that base machine.
Sure. Okay, great. Well, Alex, congratulations on your initial success, and we look forward to following you further and checking in a couple of quarters to see how it's going. Thanks for joining me today. Good to talk, and we'll be in touch.
Great. Appreciate it, James. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you.